Hey, deserving listeners, I get a lot of questions from you asking about using psychedelics, using LSD, microdosing, psilocybin, this kind of thing in therapeutic work. And although I usually like to answer such questions, it's not my area of expertise. I can look at the research, I can look at the literature, and sort of digest it and communicate it to you. But, you know, that can only go so far. So I thought I would have an expert on the podcast, Elizabeth Nielsen, to talk about this topic since so many people have so many questions about it. Welcome to the podcast, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
So can you introduce yourself to the podcast listeners, please?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Elizabeth Nielsen. I'm a psychologist. I'm based in New York City. And I do a couple of things in my professional work. I have worked for about 6 years now on clinical trials of psychedelic-assisted treatments. Those are, you know, FDA-approved trials taking place at major institutions. I've worked on trials of psilocybin for alcohol use disorder, trials of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, as well as trials of MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. So I've got a fairly big background in terms of providing therapy and research trials and also training other therapists to do that work. And then outside of that work in private practice, I also work with people, clients, patients, the public to address some harm reduction issues around psychedelic use in other settings, as well as help clinicians get educated about what's going on in the field of psychedelic research and how they can have conversations with their clients about their decisions to use psychedelics or not use psychedelics or what those experiences might have been like. So I'm doing a variety of things, and I'm hopeful that I can be here and maybe answer some questions and shed some light on some of the mysteries around this field. I am here just sort of representing myself, my own private practice work. Although I have a lengthy history in the research studies, I'm not representing any specific institution or talking on behalf of a study at this point.
So how can psychedelics be used therapeutically? You mentioned treatment-resistant depression, PTSD, addiction. Mm-hmm. Some of our listeners struggle with these things and might be excited to hear about alternatives or other methods to treating those conditions.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's in general a lot of excitement about that. What people may not be so aware of is that there was actually a fairly strong body of research and literature on the use of psychedelics, specifically mostly LSD. Dating back from the 1950s and 1960s and early 70s, before the current climate of restrictions were put into place. And so a lot of research was done, a lot of people received these treatments in experimental settings and research settings, but these drugs were never approved for therapeutic use in the way that people are attempting to get them approved now. So more recently, what we're seeing is some small pilot studies that are giving the initial indication that it may be feasible to use psychedelics in a therapeutic setting, so in combination with preparatory and integrative psychotherapy in treatment. But what I really want to emphasize is that when those medicines are used in that way, it's distinct from use in any other setting. So there's this whole psychotherapy container that goes on around it, as well as it's very experimental at this point. I mean, the research is really in its beginning stages, and the data to demonstrate actual efficacy or actually who this might be helpful for and which indications is just still in the process of being gathered right now.
So what have you seen in your practice? Do you actually use these methods with your clients?
Well, I do in research settings. And there are some great publications that address the way that those research setting psychotherapies are carried out. I can talk a little bit about some of the structures of them. For instance, in in research with alcohol use disorder, people are given preparatory psychotherapy sessions. They're given some actual counseling around changing drinking. And then they're given the psychedelic session with the support of two psychotherapists that have worked with them before and stay with them through the entire session. And then they have a couple of follow-up integrative psychotherapy sessions to help really consolidate those gains. And we call that integration. And it's designed to help people really build the insights and knowledge that they may have discovered during the psychedelic session into the course of their daily life. So to really take action based on the things that they may have experienced or learned during their experience.
Yeah, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, the protocol is that someone signs up for the study and they're saying, yeah, I suffer from ongoing addiction issues and I've tried various different things to stop, and I want to try this other method. And they will have a talk about, their history of psychedelics maybe, but they also talk about with a professional expert about what the psychedelic session is going to be like and what, to expect so that they don't have a bad trip, as they say. And then you administer the psychedelic, the LSD usually, and then they will have their experience, and there's someone there with them, as you say. Mm-hmm. You said there's two people with them, correct?
Yeah. By and large, research protocols are using two very specifically highly trained therapists that sit with the participant for the entire 8-hour session.
Yeah. And talking with them, making sure they don't have a bad trip, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And also helping them to maybe explore, is it kind of free associative for the participant, mm-hmm. or are there specific protocol questions they ask?
Well, it depends a little bit on the protocol. So first of all, I want to just go back and write one thing, which is that we're not actually using LSD in any of the trials in the United States at this point. Trials are being conducted with psilocybin, which for listeners who may be unfamiliar, is chemically and experientially similar to LSD, but it's shorter acting. It's actually the naturally occurring compound found in what's commonly known as magic mushrooms, although what we use in research settings is pure medical grade psilocybin. But to answer your question about the actual sessions, there are different approaches. For the most part, people are asked to sort of focus on their internal experience. Researchers or people conducting sessions are using eye shades and headphones and sitting with the participant, but really attempting to allow them to take off into their own internal landscape and go exploring to the extent that they're able to let go of being involved in what's going on outside of them in the room, in conversation with the therapist, but actually diving into those internal workings. Now, you mentioned also bad trips, and that's a very sort of colloquial term for often a combination of, sort of overwhelming experiences, maybe some fear, maybe some panic. And really in research, we've found that we're preparing people to, as best we can, to be open to and accept whatever experience arises. We're doing a lot of things to reassure and reduce fear. We're also, giving this in a research medical setting. So some of the factors that might be scary for people in other settings are not present, right? It's completely legal. There's medical monitoring. All of that stuff is in place. People are very well screened for any health counterindication. And but we do recognize that, sometimes people have some difficult experiences. And those, if they're sort of approached with a sense of openness and curiosity, can actually lead to some really fruitful learning and really fruitful experiences. So I think it's a little bit of a balancing act there.
So then after the session, there's a follow-up soon after?
Yeah, people come back in general in research protocols. People come back and have a integration session, a non-drug psychotherapy session, if you will, the following day, again, with the same two therapists. And depending on the, you know, the target diagnosis and the problem and why they're there and a little bit on what the protocol is, that discussion can be a place to talk about what occurred during the psychedelic session, as well as how that might translate into what's happening for them in terms of broader change in their life.
And the target conditions, we've been saying addiction, but this is a similar protocol for PTSD and depression.
There are a lot of similarities and overlap, but you know, when you're working with diagnosis specific protocols, those are always going to be slightly tailored to that population. But a lot of the procedures are a lot of the sort of general procedures that we're discussing now are fairly similar. And you see these published in, you know, for instance, the alcohol trial protocol has been well described in the literature. The MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder therapy manual is actually available online. Those studies are sponsored by a group called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Their website is maps.org, and there's a lot of resources there for people who might want to read more about this this protocol and treatment approach.
So I'm imagining, and I could be wrong about this, that the follow-up session and maybe even during the psychedelic session, there are questions about, like, if the participant is thinking, okay, I want to work on my alcohol addiction. And so there might be you know, soft, open-ended questions during and after around, like, so, you know, what was your experience and how do you think it relates to maybe the underlying reasons why you are, you know, compulsively drinking, or what kinds of discoveries did you make? And then, okay, how does that relate to your behavior? But that's just me supposing. What kind of questions or discussions are happening during those times?
For the most part, those discussions would be happening after the session. The model for psychedelic assisted therapy is actually to set up the relationship with the participant in such a way that they are able to really dive into having their own complete experience without much interference from the therapist during the experience. Now, of course, we're there. If someone needs to talk, they're having an emotional time, they need some reassurance, some assistance. But the model of psychedelic assisted therapy is really to allow people to kind of have their own profound experience that then can be discussed and integrated later. There's another model that people may be less familiar with, which is called psycholytic therapy, where usually lower doses would have been used to help people be able to have a more open frame of mind, perhaps some changes in perception and cognition, but really to be able to engage in psychotherapy during the active acute psychedelic drug effects. And that model was used and tested during the 1950s and 60s. It was developed at that time, and it was put into practice. But that, for the most part, is less of what we're doing now. We're really usually focusing on allowing people to have that full psychedelic experience and then bringing it back and discussing it later.
Yeah, so I'm trying to imagine what it would be like, or what a possible result of this would be like for someone. And I'm thinking, like, afterwards, they are thinking, you know, it's not uncommon. I've heard it from a lot of people just recreationally, their experiences with psychedelics. And they'll say things like, well, I just opened up this whole new way of looking at the world and myself, and I carry it with me now. You know, there'll be people that will say, I only used LSD 3 times and it was 10 years ago, and I still carry those wisdoms with me to help me in my life. It helps me to see that I'm connected to the universe in a way that isn't always intuitive, or it makes me realize that there's a higher purpose to everything and I don't need to worry quite as much about the day-to-day things, that worry is what led me to be, having mental illness symptoms or addiction compulsions. And with that wisdom, one, I can allow myself to occasionally have a drink, or two, I am not stressed out to the point where I need a drink. Are these the kinds of things that people are saying? I mean, just as one micro example.
So I think it may be actually helpful here to shift into talking about working with people who have had experiences outside of the research, which is something that I do in private practice and have, worked on developing a training program for therapists to learn also how to be able to do. Because we do know that a large, fairly decent percentage of people, it's been quoted as somewhere around 10% of the population of the United States, have had experiences with psychedelics. And many of those people, may come into therapy and have something like what you described, and would like to be able to discuss it, or maybe feel that they've learned something really valuable from it. So that's a known phenomenon. I mean, our position is really that, from a harm reduction standpoint, there is reason to be able to be curious about those experiences and bring those experiences into psychotherapy should someone want to.
Yeah, but I'm still making a lot of assumptions, and I'd rather have you tell me what the research is finding in terms of with the participants. What are they saying? I don't know the design of the research that you're referring to, but the research that I would come across, they're trying to reduce symptoms. They're trying to see, does this protocol actually reduce the symptom?
Right.
The target symptom. And of course, it's hard to know why that's happening. But
so what are the people? So what I'm telling you is that the large scale comparison studies, like larger scale placebo double blind trials, by and large they're not finished yet. They haven't been done yet. What we're really looking at is results from small scale pilot studies. So for instance, pilot studies where, 10 people came through the protocol, everybody got open label psilocybin. And by and large, we did see vast improvement. There was a publication of that a couple of years ago that I've spoken about at several conferences. And we do see reductions in drinking. We do see reductions in both heavy drinking and overall drinking days. We do see, across the board, very positive outcomes. But those aren't large scale comparison studies. They're not double blind. We don't know how much of that is placebo effect and those sorts of things, or how much of that is would also be accounted for by placebo effect if somebody ran the whole protocol exactly the same, but without the psilocybin. That's what's actually being tested right now. So this research is really in its infancy. There are a couple of great qualitative publications where people have talked about their experience, and the profundity of the insight is really astounding. From my own observations and from reading a lot of these reports and transcripts and things that I've worked through and published on, people are really feeling a profound shift in their internal state, their internal relationship to their drinking, and that is related to the change that they're feeling. But we don't really have such solid data as far as exactly what kinds of experiences people need to have, or to what extent the subjective experience is, how it's exactly translating into change. I think that's, it'll be great to be investigating that for the next 30, 40 years at least. But that's really in its very beginning of our understanding.
Yeah. And I appreciate your tentative scientific responses that tells me that you're a responsible science communicator. and it's helpful, I think, for people to hear this conversation and the way that you're communicating about it, partially because there's so much hype around this right now. A lot of people on the internet are saying, like, there are, or even news articles with titles like, you know, magic mushrooms cures addiction. You know, scientists prove that LSD can cure your PTSD. And right. when I would see these claims, I was skeptical, obviously, because that's a pretty fantastical claim. And if true, it can just completely rework our entire understanding of the mind and also of our industry. It'd be great. And when I looked into the research, I found, right, it would be these small pilot studies. I mean, partially because the government has been suppressing these kinds of research investigations, legal reasons, funding reasons. And so we're essentially back in the 50s with regards to our, you know, data gathering. You know, we have tons of data on Prozac, but not a lot of data on this yet. And you're saying, well, we just have to be careful about any broad claims we make. We need bigger studies. We need more time. It might take 30, 40 years for us to know. And so a lot of my response to people when they would ask me questions, little bit of investigation that I did, I came to the conclusion of like, well, we just don't know yet. Is it possible that these substances can help some people? It seems highly likely because one, the data seems to be pointing in that direction. And also it stands to reason. I mean, a lot of people like these drugs for probably some logical reasons. and so it's stands to reason that, you know, it's like if somehow caffeine was illegal or something and we were, you know, these speculations are like, I wonder if caffeine helps me work better when I'm at the office. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it stands to reason if people are using alcohol or caffeine to, you know, keep them on task at work recreationally, it's like, it's probably likely that there's some effect there. It's hard to know. And you're also careful to say, look, you know, we don't have double-blinded studies. The placebo effect is real, right? And there's just countless examples of that. But I'm curious how one could double-blind it, because you would have to give people a psychedelic experience without having administered the substance, you know, because usually with, you know, other kinds of, you know, when they do trials of, say, Prozac, you give them a pill, but there's no immediate intoxicating noticeable effect from taking Prozac, for example. And that can't be reproduced in a, you know, control. So how would you really truly eliminate the placebo effect or control for it?
I think of the studies that are doing placebo-controlled work as doing, it's more like therapy-only condition or therapy plus psychedelic condition, if you will. So people are still getting all of the psychotherapy. They're getting the session just the way they would. They're getting, you know, a placebo pill, whatever it is for the session. Some studies use an active placebo. Some use an inert placebo. But just the process, the amazing thing is that just the process of going through all of that preparation and going through that session where they're coming into the room and they're lying down and putting on these eye shades and headphones and they're sort of disconnected from the internet and all of their usual things that, you know, remind them who they are. that in itself can be a powerful experience. And, you know, people have been known to be unsure of what they got. And therapists as well can have been known to be unable to tell. I can tell you anecdotally from my own experience, I'm not always sure if someone got a placebo or an active dose of a psychedelic in a study. The situation is strange and unique enough that it is genuinely not always clear, not clear. Huh.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Like a deprivation chamber with a, you know, two people there with you. So what is that like? I mean, 8 hours, do you take a break at some point to go to the bathroom?
We definitely take a bathroom break. We definitely get up and have a stretch, you know, a quick lunch or a walk around a block. But no, really the two therapists are dedicated to being there for the day in the room with the person. Someone, one of us at least, is always present there. We'd never have both people out of the room for any period of time. And that is not just to ensure physical safety, but really to ensure the psychological safety that the patient knows that they're always there. Someone's always there to care for them. Someone's always there to assist them, to bring them water, to help them if they need to go to the bathroom, whatever it is. They're never left alone.
In the rare case where someone does have a significant fear response, what do you do?
We're really highly trained in how to provide assurance and assistance and verbal interaction with a person in a way that can help them move in and through those experiences. So it's really important that we have a good, strong relationship with them to begin with. We touch on certain topics before the session, such as, you know, potential effects and things that they may feel, and we can remind people of those things. We can help them to get a little bit more oriented or to maybe lessen the intensity of the experience by adjusting certain things in the room. And we can, you know, also be just present to sit with someone as they go through a difficult experience so that they're not with that difficult experience alone. And those are the sorts of things that I think allow people to have those experiences and let them be something that becomes part of the larger picture and something that they may actually find some insight in towards the end, as opposed to being sort of stuck in this very fearful or distressing place.
Yeah, I'm just imagining from my own experience with people who are tripping recreationally, it's like they, you know, there's so many different experiences someone would have, but they might be like sitting in a dark room or something, and it's like I'm falling into a pit, I'm falling into a giant, you know, bloody, you know, mouth is eating me, my leg or whatever they say, and you're just like, okay, I'm here, you're okay, that's not actually happening, that's what you're seeing. Do you want to turn on the lights a little bit? Do you want to turn off the music? Do you, you know, you're okay. Everything's fine. You're not alone. I'm here with you. And that can often help people. Is it that kind of stuff?
Right. So what you're citing, I think, is similar in that people who have some training in psychedelic harm reduction, for instance, for festival settings or peer settings or things like that, may know some helpful things that they could do to see someone through a difficult experience. And I'll refer again to MAPS because they have an excellent training for people that want to learn how to do psychedelic harm reduction, especially in festival settings. It's called the Zendo Project. And that's also a manual that's available on their website for free. But it's different in that if you're in a peer setting or a festival setting or another setting, you know, there may not be somebody who's there who has that expertise and that training and who is, you know, sober and dedicated to assisting you through it. And in the research settings, you know, that's really a guarantee. It's really a given. Your therapists are there specifically to help the person, and not only with what they can do, but there are, of course, a whole host of other, you know, staff and support that could be accessed if needed.
This is just you. This is just me asking you to speculate, and I don't know how comfortable you are with that. But because I would imagine some researchers would be like, "Well, okay, maybe I sometimes allow myself to speculate, but I'm not going to go on public record because that would make me people would be suspicious of me, you know, routing the data in my speculative direction. But if you're comfortable, why do you think this works?
Ah, well, that is a great question. I can cite a couple of potential routes. And again, I can say, you know, it could be any or all or some combination of these things. But these are some of the things that are already talked about in the literature. So, and there is quite a lot of writing about this. Some of it comes out of that early research stage and some of it coming in later. But for addiction specifically, when we're talking about classic psychedelics or serotonergic psychedelics such as LSD and psilocybin, there is the potential that pharmacologically those psychedelics can actually help correct or repair some of the neurobiological changes that occur with long-term compulsive use of alcohol and other drugs, and or be somewhat of a protective factor pharmacologically. Now, the neurobiological end of this is not my main expertise, but population studies and studies of groups such as syncretic churches, where a brew, which is a sacrament, which contains a naturally occurring compound, which is also in the same pharmacological class, is consumed on a weekly or biweekly basis by a large population, such as the entire, you know, congregation of the church. People have actually studied the health outcomes for those groups and demonstrated lower than would be expected rates of alcohol abuse and other types of problems. So we know that there may be some relationship there, just in terms of drugs in that class having a protective factor or some sort of factor that reduces the tendency towards addictive problems.
Couldn't that also just be experiential? I mean, if they're having a group trip into the universe, the euphoria that one experiences can maybe hold them through the difficulties of life where they don't have to turn to substances to cope. Do you know what I mean?
Potentially, but from the pharmacological level, I think that there is actually reason to believe that those compounds in that class are protective of developing or help with healing from the damage done by compulsive alcohol use.
And does that have to do with serotonin? I mean, that might be a simple question, but
yeah, it has to do with how the serotonin system gets regulated over time with compulsive addictive behavior, and how classic psychedelics can help in a corrective way for that system.
Okay.
There's some research on this was conducted by Dr. Charlie Grobe, who is at UCLA. And if you look up something called the HOSCA project, you'll find some papers on that. They actually went to visit groups that were using these medicines in a traditional context and did not only interviews, but actual biomarker measures to determine this trend and this pattern. So that's been fairly well established. Now, the other component of it is if you look at things like, the traditional approach to healing from addiction and the tenets of Alcoholics Anonymous specifically, they talk about having a spiritual experience as a key factor in healing from addiction, healing from alcoholism, right? And some of the earliest research and some of the most well-established research, especially with psilocybin, demonstrates that it can occasion a mystical or mystico-mimetic, is a word sometimes people use, experience in a laboratory setting when given in the presence of supportive psychotherapists or supportive guides that is profound and lasting and on par with mystical experiences that have been had in other contexts or for other, you know, engendered in other ways, such as through prayer or through meditative experiences and things like that. So it's possible that that subjective experience actually does contribute to putting people on the path towards healing from addiction.
Yeah. Okay. So those are the two main speculations or hypotheses.
Those are kind of two starter speculations. there are definitely a lot more. But I think it's, you know, I think in the end, what we're going to be seeing is a variety, like a mix of different mechanisms of action, and that, which mechanisms are specifically the ones responsible for change in each individual person will be somewhat of an individual profile for each person.
Right. Yeah. I think that's the key, is that similar to other psychotropics, that it there's a set of possibilities that might contribute to symptom change in an individual, and it's unknown what set mm-hmm. that individual is going to, you know, benefit from. And based on previous research, you know, pretty solid or consensus understandings of serotonin, and it stands to read. That's why I, you know, when people were kind of surprised that psychedelics were helping, I was like, well, from my memory and from, you know, biology classes and psychotropic classes, I remember, you know, these psychedelics having something to do with serotonin and other kinds of processes that were similar to other prescribed medications that are affecting the brain in at least a related way. And so mm-hmm. it makes sense that psychedelics could either benefit in a similar way or in a, you know, related way. It's well known that SSRIs can help with addiction, for example, and that involves serotonin system in the brain. And so controlled, dose, if you will, of serotonin action in the brain might have a similar effect for people. But it also stands to reason, you know, the second speculation of, being connected to the universe is a profound experience and hard to quantify, of course. But people will say, as I was saying earlier, I tripped 10 years ago at Burning Man, and every, you know, few days, I remember what happened during that moment for me. And it puts things in perspective and really helps me. I'm really glad that I went through that. I don't want to do it all the time, but, and you know, maybe never again, but, that time, you know, really, helps me. Similar to, I meditated for a week in India and I carry that with me, or I climbed Mount McKinley and was looking out over, you know, the state and the, you know, all the earth I could see before me, or, the birth of my child, mm-hmm. or the, I don't know, just various different experiences that are, well reported, all the poets and all the songwriters, or I fell in love and that redirected my life.
Absolutely. Yeah. The profundity of that experience, really does, we know from both research trials as well as, survey data and follow-up with people who've had experiences in other settings, that it really does stay with people, and it really can be a moment of pivotal change.
Do the news headlines bother you?
No, but I think sometimes, as you alluded to before, they can be... they can be overgeneralizations, and they can be a little bit misleading.
Yeah.
I'll often see people in private practice who are coming in and, seeking perhaps some guidance around a decision to try a psychedelic in a specific setting, or maybe in a retreat setting, or in a peer setting. And, a lot of the conversation can be around kind of mitigating the expectations that are set up by press that is, you know, glowingly positive, but may not really capture the full picture of what to expect or what's really going on or what the risks may be.
The other symptom or condition that I see in the research literature is around end of life mm-hmm. and how psychedelics are used to help people with their well-being as they prepare for death themselves. Mm-hmm. And they find for some people, they will, after having one of these psychedelic treatment sessions, will be more at ease with the process of dying. Do you have any familiarity with that research?
Yes. And again, that was research that initiated in as a potential indication in the 1950s and 60s. And there were some, you know, there was some experimentation with classic psychedelics, mostly LSD for that particular use. The research that was conducted more recently, it was a study that was conducted at two sites at Johns Hopkins and at NYU. It was published in 2016. And that research, it was actually a psychotherapy study where they gave people psilocybin in the context of psychotherapy that was designed to help address, elicit and address and discuss and integrate insights around end of life issues or anxiety related to a cancer diagnosis was actually the indication in that particular study. And again, you know, it was a small pilot study, but the results were positive. I mean, people saw some really profound positive changes. It's something to be cautious about because it's not really enough or, you know, results of a long enough duration to have an indication and an approval for that use. But it certainly contributes to the pool of knowledge that we have about this medicine and how it might be used in order to help people that are suffering in that way. And my sincere hope is that the rest of the research that would be needed to demonstrate that it could be used safely and reliably for that particular in that particular way can be conducted such that it will become available, because certainly adding stress and anxiety to an end of life care situation when someone is really struggling to cope with that diagnosis and that knowledge, it really, really affects not just that person's experience of their own death, but the experience, I think, of everyone around them, all of their family and caregivers. And I think there's a great potential for improving offerings for people in that situation.
Yeah, I completely agree. I really hope that, I mean, one of the barriers is societal and governmental and political, cultural resistance to this. And it's ridiculous, and it that has to stop. I suspect it will. Trends are heading in that direction. Legalization of marijuana seems to be the, you know, at the sort of the chevron of movement, or more a grown up understanding of these substances. You know, we don't have to have a Nixonian idea of these substances. And and it totally stands to reason, especially as more people become atheistic, more people become atheists and don't believe in an afterlife or don't believe in a God, you know, where religion may have provided those experiences for people in the past. It's harder to have that experience maybe for some people. And so having this tool to connect people with the universe, for lack of a better phrase, you know, it totally stands to reason. You know, you'll hear people, whether end of life or not, with a having, like I said, climbing Mount McKinley, or, you know, their child being born. These are profound experiences that psychology often doesn't really focus on, you know, as a thing to try to harness for the betterment of human beings. And I think that psychedelics might be, you know, involving that for a lot of people. So what about when people are talking about microdosing? What's that all about?
So microdosing is another area where I think the perhaps the perception of what research exists or the safety of that practice has been misestimated. So I'll talk about that a little bit. Microdosing in psychedelics refers to the practice of taking a small dose of a psychedelic, usually about a tenth of an active or full dose, and doing so on a either a daily or every few days basis. You'll hear people say that microdosing is taking a sub-perceptual dose. I think a better word would be a sub-psychedelic dose, or a dose that has some perceptible effect as far as change in mood or change in just body feeling or sensation, things like that, maybe an energy level or creativity, but that is not intoxicating or moving someone into a space where they're sort of disconnected from their normal, being able to conduct their normal routine. And that dose is going to be, you know, mean different things for different people. The practice of microdosing really came to light and was initially, I think, documented and researched by a psychologist by the name of Jim Fadiman, who is based in California. And he has recently, meaning the last in this recent resurgence of psychedelic research, he's designed a way to study microdosing by essentially coming up with a protocol for how often and what kinds of things people might record about their microdosing experience, and allowing people to self-select and submit their own data about their own experiences. And he's collected quite a large body of literature and of experiences, and has compiled and written and published and spoken about this. And it makes, you know, quite a compelling case for the fact that this is something that's happening. It's being documented, and people are, the people that are documenting it and sending in these reports are really reporting some positive changes. But what's really important to remember about that is that it's self-selecting, not blinded, or so no placebo-controlled studies. So it's all self-report data from people that are, you know, choosing to do this on their own and know that they're doing it, and doing it with the expectation of a positive result, right? Right. But it is very interesting. it's fascinating, and it's wonderful, and a really a testament to his dedication to the field that he has been able to gather so much documentation about this practice. Because of the fact that psychedelics are so closely regulated and controlled, and right now the way things are for research study, the therapists need to stay with people who take psychedelics in the research setting for the duration of 8 hours after they take the psychedelic. There aren't really studies where people are being given microdoses, in a research setting and allowed to kind of go out and go about their day, and then it's documented whether or not it's a placebo or a microdose. That's not something that's happening. I know that some people are trying to get something like that off the ground, but because of the regulatory situation, it's quite challenging. There is another study that's a very interesting design that is going on in Europe, where people are asked to basically self-blind their own microdoses. So if they're going to be microdosing, they're given a formula, like a printable document where they can label their doses, and they create their own placebo doses and their own microdoses, and then they mix them all up, and there's a coded way that they're able to take a random selection of those doses and report back to the study which coded envelope they took, so that the study knows which dose they took on which day, but the participant doesn't actually. But again, limited as in people are supplying their own actual psychedelics to participate in the study. And so also, you know, self-selecting as far as who's going to be doing that. So those are some of the attempts to study this, but we don't really know, again, what the long-term effects are, what the health effects are, or how this would compare to, for instance, other interventions or traditional, you know, the use of traditional psychotropic meds.
Yeah, like I said, it stands to reason that this would have some effect, however limited, and some benefit for some people, however limited, and maybe, you know, a moderate amount of people could benefit moderately, given that it involves brain chemistry, and that is at least akin to other demonstrated, well-researched psychotropics. It stands to reason that there would be a signal there in the data. Having said that, I'm old enough to remember various different hype around other, you know, magic pills. For example, Prozac, I mentioned earlier. I'm old enough to remember when that was considered to be a miracle drug for all sorts of things. And the headlines would state that people were, you know, even prescribers and scientists saw it that way. As we've gathered more data over the past, you know, 30 years, this effect size is getting smaller and smaller compared to placebo. And although there's an effect size, there's an effect for some people, it certainly isn't the miracle drug that it was seen as when it first hit the scene. And I don't know if that's what psychedelics will experience in terms of the data over the next 30, 40 years, but it certainly seems possible. And obviously I have no idea, but when I start hearing these headlines and I start hearing because I remember people anecdotally talking about, and I don't doubt their experience, and I'm not necessarily accusing them of being subjected to a placebo effect, but it just seemed like the rhetoric among clinicians and among scientists and among the media around Prozac had a very similar beginning to the way psychedelics has. And it also just seems like there's a certain amount of people out there who just like the idea of psychedelics as a regular part of their life, or as a nice thing, you know, for society or something. And I just feel like there's, and you're, you know, very responsible in your language and in your practice. And so I guess I just wanted to say that. Do you have any feelings about that rant I just went on?
Yeah, well, it's a great rant. Fantastic. Well done, Rhett. I mean, I get that. I mean, I am cautious, and I'm certainly I have my cautious hat on today, because the last thing that I want is for anyone, your listeners included, in that category, to experience harm because of this. And I think that there is certainly the potential for that. You know, the harms of psychedelics are not the same kinds of harms that we see in relation to, you know, alcohol use and opiates and, you know, maybe even other psychotropic drugs that could have some really profound neurological problems and things like that associated. But there really is a potential for harm, especially with use in uncontrolled settings or around people who may be unsafe and inexperienced, or for people who have some real psychological struggles and difficulties for whom psychedelics can be a profoundly just disorienting or dysregulating experience. So I'm also very optimistic about the research. I mean, I'm witnessing firsthand some of the really profound change that is possible. But there's a lot that we don't know about how to work with this and how to really provide it to people in a way that's going to be a consistently safe and therapeutic experience. And what we're doing in the trials really, it doesn't translate to other settings. You can't count on getting those same kind of results in another setting. You know, it doesn't mean that people don't have also some positive experiences and some truly healing experiences in other settings. But they're not, they're not a guarantee, you know, there's definitely a risk and potential for harm there.
Yeah. The interesting part of your describing the protocol is that the headlines will say psychedelics cure PTSD, but the headline should say psychedelics plus a very specific psychotherapy protocol helped to reduce yeah. PTSD symptoms. Because it's right. not just like they just throw psychedelics at these people and they walk away and come back. It's a very specific human interaction with a expert clinician therapist mm-hmm. who is there and also thereafter to actually integrate this stuff. And of course, that's what they found with SSRIs was that when you combined SSRIs with psychotherapy, then that seemed to be the magic sort of combination. And from my biology classes, I remember the professor talking about how they originally thought, okay, SSRIs are actually helping with the brain chemistry, but his and maybe, you know, other experts, their hypothesis was Prozac and other serotonin acting substances. One hypothesis is that it opens the mind up to be changed, but you have to actually actively try to change it through either self-reflection or through psychotherapy. And mm-hmm. by just taking the medication, it just sort of, makes your brain flexible to a new state. And you have to capitalize on that flexibility in a way that's very specific. And you can't rely on people to just come up with that, new homeostasis naturally. There has to be some kind of engineering to get it there. And so that's one thing. And yeah, I mean, getting to the harm, I know anecdotally that for people who recreationally will take psychedelics will experience trauma because of the bad trips or, some other kind of effect that was not pleasant for them. It's not guaranteed that you're going to have a great time. And the trip, if, taken normally, can last for hours and hours. So if you get into a bad spot, like you could be in that bad spot for a long time. Now, of course, there are ways to help people that a lot of people don't turn to when they could, or it's not offered to them. That could definitely help. But there is that risk. Even under a controlled environment, it's much lower risk according to the data, right? But the other is that, from my understanding of the research, that's hard to know exactly, but it can trigger in a very rare case, psychosis for some people, which can last well beyond the use. It is something to consider before going into this, that what you're talking about is a very controlled scenario that is meant to reduce those risks.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and I think just speaking in, to the general population of people who are either, accessing a psychotherapist or who are a psychotherapist, one of the things that I'm doing in my private practice work, but my work outside of the research settings is to help build programs for therapists to become more educated about even just some of the simple harm reduction preparation and integration concepts that they can use in a very basic introductory conversation with someone, because we really feel that a lot of those harms can be mitigated by sort of thinking some things through both ahead of time and afterward. And you mentioned, you know, people having bad experiences or difficult experiences that can kind of extend for some period of time after the acute psychedelic effects should have worn off. And one of the things that we do in our trainings is start to educate clinicians about what to look for, what to assess for, how to provide verbal reassurance, how to reduce harm should they see something like that, as well as what else can be, you know, might they try to do for somebody who's in such a situation, both from a perspective of keeping them safe, but also from a perspective of reducing long-term, any long-term potential for long-term negative consequences, right?
Yeah. How do you, both in your, what you're calling your private practice and the research, get around the legal risks and the lawsuit risks?
Well, in research, you know, everything that we're doing is completely legal, and we're, you know, we have all the relevant approvals from the FDA and the DEA, and it's not illegal to do this research, given that you have the correct approvals and you're following the law. And there, the law does allow for this research to be done, and it always has. It just took a really long time from the time that those laws were put into place, the more restrictive laws that we have now, which really went into place in the early 1960s, in order to protect the public from you know, unscrupulous use of drugs without proper research data, to researchers with psychedelics being able to meet those standards and conduct approved research studies. So all of that is being followed, and the research work is completely above board. In terms of other work, you know, in private practice with people, I work from a harm reduction perspective. I don't refer anyone for psychedelic therapy underground. I don't refer people to retreat centers that are offering psychedelics or in any way, you know, offer or indicate or recommend or suggest or anything like that, because my position is that, you know, if this is a decision that someone wants to make, that it's their decision, but it's not something that I can recommend as their healthcare provider. A couple things I can do are refer people to clinical trials, and, you know, tell them, educate them about what trials are available in their area, and what it might mean to be able to participate in one. I also can recommend and work with people to have ketamine experiences, which are available legally through MD providers that provide ketamine infusions. And a lot of the same principles of psychedelic assisted therapy can be used around before and after ketamine experience. And if people, you know, have gone to take a psychedelic of their own accord in another setting, I can work with them to reduce the potential for harm surrounding that experience, or to integrate the insights that they have from that experience. And that's really where private practice work is at, and what we are teaching therapists to be able to begin to do in their own work.
So by harm reduction, I'm guessing what you are referring to is someone knows that you are open to discussing the use of psychedelics recreationally, not prescribed by you at all and not recommended by you, but mm-hmm. they know that you're, you know, that's your focus, and they say, okay, you know, this therapist is open to this, and I want to explore this. She knows the research, and they, you know, I guess technically speaking, recreationally, but they're trying to do something with it. They're trying to reduce their depression. They're trying to address their addiction. They're trying to help with some trauma or something, or some other issue. And they will take the psychedelic on their own. And then in the sessions with you, you will help them to reduce harm by maybe helping them set up these environments at home so that they aren't at risk of having bad trips and this kind of thing, mm-hmm. and or integrating the experience afterwards for the benefit of whatever goal they're trying to work on. Do I have this right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a fairly good description of it. I mean, what's one of the things that's always important to convey to people is that there's no way that we can or would be reproducing what happens in the research, because what we're doing is, a harm reduction around them having, making their decision to have their own experience as opposed to engaging them in psychedelic assisted therapy. But I think that there's a lot that can be done as far as helping people to, make balanced decisions, consider the risks and benefits of deciding either way about something, maybe considering alternatives, maybe getting educated about ways to keep themselves safe or about potential backup plans, safety plans, and things like that. So there is actually quite a lot that can be done there. And I think that for people who understand and want to sort of make their own autonomous decision, that a harm reduction therapy approach is extremely helpful. Our harm reduction background comes really through Dr. Andrew Tatarsky and the Center for Optimal Living in New York, a place that my business partner and I worked for several years and received some training and supervision. And his model is called integrative harm reduction psychotherapy. And it really integrates psychodynamic therapy principles with harm reduction and mindfulness and other ways of supporting people in examining their relationship to a substance or drug that they might use or consider using, as well as bringing the relationship with the therapist into the picture for support and guidance and building the client's autonomy around their own decisions.
And for those who don't know what harm reduction is in general, if I might quickly summarize it from my understanding, is that for a long time in the chemical dependency world, abstinence was the recommendation and for many people, the only answer to having a life that wasn't without troubles. Right. And then harm reduction came along and said, okay, yeah, abstinence can be very helpful to a lot of people. But for some people, this other model of not necessarily accepting that abstinence is the only answer, that maybe talking openly about the substance use and its effects and reducing harm. Maybe it's through moderation. Maybe it's through the circumstances under which you use or even the specific substances you use.
Right.
And there has been traditionally tremendous controversy in the chemical dependency world between these two camps, because for the abstinence only camp, this is perceived by some to be just an excuse for addicts to continue to use and to play around with their lives in some ways. Whereas harm reduction people are just trying to look at, when they look at the data and they're just trying to be more realistic about for some people, not only because for some people it's really hard for them to quit, but for some people it's actually not a problem for them to, overall to use occasionally. It's, obviously individual basis, but that's what harm reduction, the field, in general is. How do you think about malpractice, as a fellow practicing clinician? And as someone who supervises a lot of paranoid supervisees and trains a lot of paranoid trainees, I imagine a lot of listeners are like, wait a second, I'm worried about losing my license if I accept a gift from a client, for crying out loud. Like this woman's like supervising these people using drugs, LSD, like, holy crap, What do you do?
Well, first of all, one thing I make clear to all of my my patients in private practice, and I'll just iterate right now that my private practice is tiny at this point, just because of so much teaching and training and research responsibilities. But I initially learned and trained in a harm reduction model. This is going back, I don't even want to say, an embarrassing number of years, a while ago. But right since the beginning of even my, master's level clinical hours and, before I was even going into my PhD program, I was thinking about ways and practicing training in environments where harm reduction was supported and welcomed and used. And so right off the bat, was working with and comfortable working with people who were not necessarily abstinent from all drugs and alcohol as a prerequisite requirement to be in therapy. So in a way, it's not a departure from that. The same way that I wouldn't necessarily kick a patient out of my psychotherapy practice because they went out on a Friday night and used some cocaine, nor would I kick someone out of my psychotherapy practice if they came back from an ayahuasca retreat, right? There's a parallel there, and it can be helpful to think of it that way because we tend to, maybe put psychedelics in a different category from all other substances. But sometimes it's helpful to revert to like, what happens if we just, switch the name out and think of it as any other substance. And from a legal standpoint, I think that's probably how it's mostly, would be considered. Now, the decision-making is a little bit different around it. That is one way to kind of conceptualize it. The idea that people, any drug use and all drug uses of any kind, psychedelic or otherwise, is bad, and people shouldn't be, we should just sort of come at it with a pre-formulated idea that it shouldn't be there and it should be reduced or it should be gone in order for people to be in psychotherapy, is actually pretty damaging and excludes a lot of people and a lot of people's actual experience from what they're able and willing to talk about in psychotherapy. So I see it as my responsibility to welcome people's experiences into my psychotherapy sessions and be open to what they're experiencing. And if my patients are telling me, I think this is going to be helpful for me and I want to talk about it, then that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah. I find that dogma is still around, frustratingly, that if a client is actively using substances, but only in a specific class, right? If they have a couple glasses of wine on Friday night, we don't exclude people. But if some, and more, this is more in the past, but I think still around, if they're smoking pot every other day or using psychedelics every other day, somehow there's this dogma in our field that it's just like, well, you can't treat that person. They got to work on their addiction. They got to become abstinent before you can work with them in psychotherapy because therapy is like useless in that situation. And I'm just like, okay, show me the research on that one because that is not supported by the science. Plus, right. It's like, completely just on its face ridiculous when you understand humans and you understand substances and you take into consideration the commercial with Ben Affleck flipping out on the ground having used marijuana, if you remember that commercial back in the 90s. This notion of substances just completely change you into this substance zombie or something that can't be, you're just like a completely different state of animal, is just silly. And somehow caffeine is off the hook. Like I said, occasional alcohol use is off the hook.
Right. And, I mean, that kind of, it's a sort of a pervasive idea and culture. And it's one thing that it's resulted in is not very good education about varieties of experiences with substance use. And about psychedelics as potential having potential healing properties in graduate education. So I think it's just, it's something, it's like a big missing piece of a lot of therapists' education. I run into a lot of therapists who feel, you know, oh, I can't work with addictions. I don't have that particular special experience or training. I'm not in that club. And I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, I think these are sort of varieties of human suffering, and there's a lot more about all of this that's universal, as opposed to qualitatively different. And when I train therapists to do harm reduction integration work with psychedelics, one of the main principles is really that I think, you know, good therapists have a lot already on board to contribute. It's not a whole different set of skills one would need to learn, but good therapeutic technique, good rapport, good care and concern about your clients, and openness and willing to listen to their experience. And those are the basic building blocks of it.
Has there been any test cases in Department of Health or in civil suits that involve a patient who is in something similar or even your form of approach who, say, attempts suicide or completes suicide or drives while intoxicated, gets an accident, the patient or the family looks into it, sues the practitioner, the clinician, accusing them of approving of the substance use or encouraging it or not taking a harder stance against the substance use for the duty to protect standard. Has there been any case around that? Because I could see something like that. I could see a family or an individual making that claim.
What I can say is that, you know, I'm not familiar with all of the case law around all of what has transpired with all the harm reduction cases and people in harm reduction therapy. You know, certainly it does happen when in the unfortunate case, when someone who's in therapy or in treatment completes suicide or has some other really adverse outcome, that there can be lawsuits. It does happen. But harm reduction psychotherapy in general, and as an approach to working with addictive behaviors, is certainly well established and certainly stands its ground as a recognized and valued and widely practiced approach.
Right. Thus, the standard of care defense stands. But yes. but it is different, at least from my understanding of what you're talking about. You know, someone comes in and says, and I get the the protective factor of saying, look, we're working within the harm reduction model, which I think is valid. But philosophically, it feels different to me enough, at least to provide the potential for, hostile lawyers, so to speak, to find that crack in that when someone comes in and they're like, look, I've been struggling with alcohol use on and off in my life, and I've tried AA, I've tried abstinence. It doesn't really work. I want to try a new approach. And you say, oh, well, there's harm reduction. Okay. So you have these conversations with them about like, how can you, use a little bit, but not so much that you're causing tremendous harm in your life. And maybe there's some side effects, like, you're a little tired the next day, or you can't do work while you have a few glasses of wine two times a week or something. So that, you know, it's not without its negative consequences, but you get the benefit of the fact that you're not white knuckling it. You're not, shaming yourself for quote unquote relapsing. And, you know, there's all these kinds of ways. So, you know, that's a kind of a very simplistic harm reduction example, but what you're talking about is different. You're talking about, okay, you're using, psychedelics. Obviously, I'm not going to dictate your life. And, what kind of approach do you want to have? And the person's like, well, I want to occasionally use, and I want to talk about it with you as a way of integrating those experiences as to better my life in one way or another. And so you're, in a sense, it's at least perceived by the client that this psychedelic usage outside of therapy is, in essence, an adjunct to therapy. So to me, it is philosophically different. I do respect and would defend the, you know, the usage of the harm reduction umbrella standard, because I do think it does apply in essence, but it is kind of different, don't you think?
It's, I see it as an extension of the underlying harm reduction principles, and maybe actually a selection of them. But one thing that might also be helpful to consider is what would be the opposite, right? So the opposite might be, you know, not providing any psychoeducation, telling the person this is not something you should do, really like making a very clear, taking a very clear prohibitive stance about it. And from our perspective, that has the potential to actually do harm, right? Because then they're less likely to learn ways to protect themselves. They're less likely to engage in a really thoughtful consideration of it, or engage in some really balanced decision making. And that has the potential to actually sort of increase the harms of not just stigma and isolation, but lack of information that can enhance the risks. So I feel much better that I'm able to provide people with some education and some ways of making a more suitable decision, as opposed to just coming out as from a prohibitive stance, which is probably going to put them in a place where they're less likely to be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to hammer on this too much, but I just find that for me, since I don't do this work, I tend to rail against society in these ways. You know, if someone said, I want to talk about going hiking once a week and how those experiences are helping me with my goals in therapy. And so, therapist, can you, and you're a hike focused therapist. Mm-hmm. Every session I'm going to talk about my hike that I went on Sunday, and I'm going to talk about how, I thought about this and I ran into these people and I saw a elk and it just helped me in this way. And I meditated on the death of my parents and I want to talk about that. We don't have to frame that in a harm reduction model, right? We're just like, great, you know, your life is your life. Are there risks to hiking? Yeah. But I'm not in the business of telling people what to do or telling people how to live their lives. So, you know, do you know the risks, fella? Yeah, I know that. Okay, fine. You know, let's talk about it. Somehow when it comes to psychedelic exploration for people, we have to frame it in this this way in which it at least gives the impression, or you know, the very you know real action of us, you know, cautioning people against the ill effects of the substance, even though it's an adult doing something. You know what I mean?
I mean, absolutely, and that's something that is very well, I think, very thoroughly discussed and very openly discussed in the harm reduction psychotherapy setting, and certainly documented that it's discussed. But, you know, one thing that might help to mention is that oftentimes what people come to us with questions about doing is not actually illegal. People are coming to us with questions about, you know, for instance, taking a psychedelic that is would mean going abroad to take it in a retreat setting where it's simply unregulated, or it's legal but not actually a medical use situation. So there's a lot of sort of gray areas around that that we can help people to understand what that means. What does it mean to go somewhere where this particular compound is not regulated, and what might they expect? Also to help evaluate, you know, the other people that might be providing it to them and might be there with them during the during said experience. We do a lot of educating about alternatives, especially because of the media, like you mentioned before. People will sometimes come in really with the idea that this is the only thing that would help them. I consider it a successful discussion when someone leaves with you know, an idea about some of the other options and alternatives that might be out there for them. One of the things that I'm really invested in studying and I'm practicing myself, certainly, is work with other methods for accessing alternative states of consciousness. So non-drug methods such as meditation, yoga, breath work, sensory deprivation, all kinds of other things that can really give people a lot of what they are seeking without the actual psychedelic compound. So there's just a lot of variety that can go into that conversation. It can really open up the possibilities for people.
So my last question for you, Elizabeth, is why did you choose this as a focus in your career? I mean, it's certainly an interesting area to look into, and you seem passionate about it. Why did you choose this?
Absolutely. I come from a community where knowledge about the psychedelic history was fairly well distributed. It was fairly well known. So it wasn't a mystery to me. I think a lot of people were unaware of what happened in the 1950s and 60s and the whole surge of LSD research and Timothy Leary and prohibition and all of that. But I was well aware of that. And when I went to graduate school, I was actually surprised that I heard virtually nothing about it. I knew that, psychedelic research had stopped and psychedelics obviously were not available legally. But it was sort of during this period of not much going on. Maybe a few studies had restarted, but they were so small and obscure that I certainly had no way of hearing about them until I was just a few months away from defending my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation. And I had studied a lot of different approaches to working with addictions and harm reduction and mindfulness-based approaches, a lot of things that were in some way related, but I didn't quite have the full picture yet. And I received an email through my state psychological association listserv, which if every therapist is not already connected with your state psychological association or similar group, this is a real reason to be. A local institution was looking for someone to join a study as a therapist. And it was very clearly a psilocybin-assisted treatment study. They were looking for a lot of the things that I had on my, checked off on my years of experience. And it just seemed like the perfect fit. It was like an immediate click for me. This makes perfect sense. Yes. I was like, where have these people been? I'm so glad that this is happening. And I went in, I called them up and I went over and had an interview. And the team, was really happy to work with me. We kind of hit it off right away. And from there, it was just a long, slow process of patience and training and returning and, keeping up with all kinds of different requirements and credentials and, institutional trainings and specific research trainings and to eventually be able to build, this is, 6 years later, a really full-fledged, full-time career in both clinical research, private practice, and education. So I know that there are a lot of people out there that are really, really interested in this field. I have to say, if you want to go into research, make sure that you actually want to go into research, because the world of clinical research has its own whole set of regulations and requirements and things that you need to learn and know about, and they're fascinating if you've got that particular type of nerd hat. But if it's something that you're more interested in from a psychotherapist perspective, I think now is the time to start getting some training in psychedelic harm reduction and integration, start having, conversations with people who've used psychedelics in your practice, just so you get a feel for what that's like. And in the next couple of years, there are going to be more and more opportunities, pending the research moving forward in the direction that we expect, there's going to be more and more opportunities for people to get training actually in psychedelic assisted therapy and how to administer and how to really be there with people during that experience. But those training opportunities are not really online yet, because There's no opportunity to use that that kind of training in private practice quite yet at this time.
Well, you must be naturally an out-of-the-box, unafraid thinker and liver, because most people having faced with that opportunity would, especially at that stage of one's career where people are at their most paranoid, most people would have turned it down even if they wanted to do it. So, you know, you're a brave, courageous.
Oh no, I was all in. Thank you. I appreciate that. But I really have to say, you know, I had the background to recognize and know what I was looking at. And I'm very grateful that I did. But I also had some, I did get some funny looks. I will admit that I got some funny looks. And, you know, it's one thing to be able to just tell people, this is what I'm doing, this is what I believe in. And sometimes you just have to do what you believe in.
You say you have a background, and the thing that popped into my head was this stereotype of like your parents were deadheads or something. I don't know. Like, what do you mean by a background?
My parents were not quite deadheads, but my mom was a bit of a hippie. She grew up in New York City and she moved to Woodstock in 1968. Which for those unfamiliar is about 2 hours north of New York City. And it was sort of this hippie cultural center, which gave rise to the famous Woodstock concert of 1969. And I grew up in that community long after the heyday of the hippie years. But I was definitely exposed to a lot of the stories of the people of her generation, the artists and the musicians that were really prominent at that time. They were all still around, and they were my parents' friends. They were like the moms and dads picking us up after elementary school, and they would just tell us stories about this stuff. It was no secret. It was just, you know, well, that's what our parents' generation was up to, and we're out here like normal kids, you know, playing soccer and going to theater and getting off to college and trying to figure out what we're doing with our lives. But I think that the stories of that generation were definitely sort of baked into my my community.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, I of course knew about Woodstock, but I never knew why they chose Woodstock. I thought it was just a convenient campground or a, you know, festival ground for them to have the festival. I didn't know that it had already become kind of a New York hippie bastion.
Oh yeah, it was actually always a colony of the arts for years, even many years before that, because artists from New York City would come up, and the Art Students League had its summer school there, and there were all these like artists' cottages where sculptors and painters and musicians would come up and spend the summer in the mountains, and that had been well established for many years. And then in the 1960s. So the folk musicians and Bob Dylan and the hippies started showing up, and it was already established as that. And the Woodstock Festival was named for the town because the organizers and many of the musicians had a relationship to that town. But the festival was actually held in another county, you know, like a 50 or 60 minute drive away. It was not actually in town.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So any famous names that you can drop here? But, you know, you said, you know, the musicians were your, you know, the other parents in the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're familiar with, for those familiar with Bob Dylan, you know, he lived in Woodstock for a very long time. The band that was the band that played with him, named The Band, they lived in Woodstock for quite a long time, and many of them remained there over the years. We're good friends with my mom and her family, and just a lot of people from town, a lot of artists and other, you know, other musicians that lived there. Certainly the town is famous for having you know, extended visits or residences from Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, people that came through the area. But it was pretty well frequented.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a perfect story, you know, the kid from Woodstock becomes a psychologist and does good by the community.
oddly enough, though, it wasn't my goal to get involved in psychedelic therapy. I didn't even know it would be an option by the time I got that far, you know, 15 years out into adulthood. And, you know, it sort of just landed in my inbox. So it's a bit of a coincidence, but definitely not a far-fetched thing for me.
Yeah. I think Timothy Leary was at Woodstock, if I'm not mistaken, or at least his disciples would have been, right? And to think that if they only would have known that a local, you know, psychologist person would end up carrying the torch and doing the cause and making it legit.
Absolutely.
That's pretty interesting.
What a lot of people might not know is that Leary was a psychologist.
Yeah. And a professor at Stanford.
Harvard. He had a fascinating career, fascinating life, really one of my favorite topics in history. It's a lot of fun to read about. But his mansion in the 1960s, after he left Harvard, his mansion was actually in Millbrook, New York, which is about a 45-minute drive south of Woodstock. So he was in the area, but he wasn't actually living in town.
Didn't he spend time in prison because of his advocacy in the 60s?
Absolutely. Yeah. He was in prison. He was in jail in California. He escaped. And he was...
He escaped from prison?
Yeah. He escaped from prison in California. And then he was recaptured somewhere in Europe. And I apologize, I don't have the story so fresh in my mind, but he was recaptured. Nixon was very determined to bring him back and get him back into prison. And he actually served quite a substantial amount of time in solitary confinement.
Wow.
He was at Harvard for about 2 years. And while he was there, he specifically, you know, decided to make psilocybin and LSD research the main focus of his interest, and conduct research with those drugs while he was there. It was really after he left Harvard that he became sort of this outspoken advocate for widespread LSD use. He certainly had an extremely interesting life. And I mean, much has been written about it. And I think we're starting to understand things a little bit better in perspective. But I feel for years he was sort of scapegoated as, you know, the reason that psychedelics were prohibited. But history actually indicates that, you know, there were multiple factors that contributed to that. You know, his sort of outlandish, outspoken nature made him like a sensationalized character who it's easy to sort of pinpoint as, oh, you know, it was this guy's fault. But he actually contributed quite a lot to the cause for LSD and was pretty well respected by a lot of people, still is.
Was he the one who said, tune in, turn on, drop out?
Yep, that was him.
Yeah.
He also said something to the effect of LSD has the remarkable capacity to cause great panic in people who've never taken it.
Interesting. Well, Elizabeth, it's been fascinating. We branched off into a lot of areas that I didn't expect to. And you certainly seem like a very responsible science communicator, which I appreciate greatly. And it's an exciting field. Where can people find you, not only as a therapist, a clinician, but also as a trainer and as a maybe an advisor for people wanting to get into the research? How can they find you?
The best way to find me is through my website, which is the name of my training and education program is Fluence. And the website is fluence8, that's the digit 8.com. So FLUENCE8.com. And on that website, you'll find a lot of information about different training programs. There is a form to contact us as well as an info email, and a phone number, and all of that contact stuff works. It links directly to either to me or to my business partner, who is Dr. Ingmar Gorman, another psychologist in New York, who's also in the research world. And we look forward to hearing from anybody who's interested. It's just us right now working on this project. So you'll if you reach out, you'll hear back from one of us, and we'll try to get you connected to whatever it is that might help meet your needs.
What's Fluence referred to?
Fluence is, so it's the name of our training and education project. It's the root of words like confluence and influence. And it can mean something like either a magical or mystical power, or has something to do with the measure of intensity of an electrical current, or the density of particles in an electrical current. So it has some meanings both in science and can refer to a mystical power. And it's also the word that we chose just to be our name.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Elizabeth Nielsen. I encourage people to reach out to Elizabeth Nielsen if you have more specific questions. She is offering quite a service to you in that way. I know a lot of you have very specific questions and want to know more. And so it's great that Elizabeth is offering herself up, at least to redirect you to the right answers. And that's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And hope your listeners have enjoyed this and will continue their own trajectory of learning about this topic with the resources that are out there. There's just so much to learn. It's really fascinating.
All right. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.